Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Sam Westrup. He is the head of Middle East Forum, and we're talking about Islamism and the concerns that he has, and many others as well, for the growing movement of Islamism, both here in North America and abroad as well. Briefly about Sam, he headed up Islamist Watch since March of 2017 when Middle East Forum absorbed the Counter-Extremism Unit of Americans for Peace and Tolerance, where he previously worked as research director. Before that, he ran Stand for Peace, a London-based counter-extremism organization monitoring Islamists throughout the UK. Mr. Westrup is a fellow at the Gatestone Institute, Scholars for Peace in the Middle East, and the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. His writings have appeared at such publications as National Review, National Post, and The Hill, and he regularly appears on television and radio stations, including the BBC and Al Jazeera. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Sam Westrup. Hello, Sam.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
Certainly. To recap, for anyone who might not have heard us last week, we're talking about Islamism and Islam, which obviously there is a relationship, but there are distinct differences. Islam is a religion. Islamism, as you say, is a political movement started in the 20th century. And so we need to make sure people understand when we say Islam, when we say Islamism, we're not always talking about the same thing. And last week we talked about how you work with moderate Muslims, and I'm wondering, who are your Muslim allies, and are they seen as pariahs in their community? Are they seen like sometimes you have African-American people who, because they ally themselves with certain people, they're considered Uncle Toms. They're considered traitors. Yeah. Do your allies have to deal with this as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I should add that the main voices behind accusations of... You know, this is not new. Every extremist, every collectivist ideology has what it calls its counter-revolutionaries. And yes, they might be Uncle Toms when it's relating to racial communities. When it's relating to Islamism, it's usually they're often referred to as kafirs, as kuffar, as non-believers, as heretics. Now, the main voices behind such accusations, more often than not, are yes, the Islamists, and also their far left supporters. Far left allies of Islamists who have long attacked and gone after reformist Muslims. A really good example of this, and I'm not a really good example is the SPLC, and I'm not referring to the SPLC as necessarily a far left organization, but it does have some far left impulses. And the Southern Poverty Law Center went after Majid Nawaz, a very prominent reformist Muslim, head of the Quilliam Foundation, who's dedicated his life to fighting extremism, fighting hate, fighting Islamism. And the Southern Poverty Law Center referred to him as a hate activist or an anti-Muslim activist. Of course, the SPLC was sued and admitted they were wrong and paid out, in fact. But this is not the first time this has happened. I see it once a month. I see reformist Muslims being attacked as anti-Muslim, which is preposterous. Last week, I referred to the Muslim community being very diverse. And in fact, that term I just used, Muslim community, is wrong. It's Muslim communities, plural. Because Islam is so diverse, it means that there is not one single Muslim community that anyone can possibly hope to represent in the U.S. There are hundreds. And just as you have hundreds of different types of extremists, you also have hundreds of different types of reformists. You mentioned Black Americans earlier. Within Black American Islam, well, on the one hand, you have a Nation of Islam, which I think everyone knows, although most Muslims would regard that not as Islamic. But then out of Nation of Islam came Warrick Dean Mohammed, a very moderate Sunni Muslim movement that is active around the country today and is involved in some reformist anti-Islamist efforts as well. But then out of Nation of Islam, you also got black Salafism. You've got these hundreds of young black activists, young Muslims who went to Saudi Arabia to train, to become imams, and then came back to spread radicalism here today. And in fact, black Salafi terrorism is a thing. There have been a number of specifically black Salafi terrorists and domestic terrorist movements in the U.S. over the last 20, 30 years. So just as extremists are found everywhere, so are moderates. So I mentioned the black community, but then there's also sort of what's referred to as reformism, which is a sort of an attempt to transcend the usual divisions within Islam and among Muslim communities to build a broader anti-Islamist base. And that culminated in something called the Muslim Reform Movement. The leading voices behind that being people like Zudi Jatta, a very brave, prominent reformist Muslim activist. People like Raheel Raza, a very prominent Canadian reformist. Azra Nomani, a former journalist. She was a good friend of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street journalist murdered in Pakistan by Islamists. So there's a wide variety of people behind Muslim reform movement, and they're trying to build a broader base. And they're trying to bring reformists from other areas of Islam. For example, I believe that a number of Quranists are involved with the Muslim reform movement. And Quranists are people who say, you know, these are reformists in the sense they want to actively reform the religion of Islam. They look at the Quran and the Sunnah and the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, and they say, we reject all of that. We just want to follow the Quran, only the Quran. Only the Quran is the authentic instructions and word of God, so we will just follow the Quran. This upsets, of course, Islamists enormously, who direct great threats of violence and hate towards such people. So I could go on. The point is, reformism is a very big tent. Not all reformers get along. The best hope for reformists right now is the Muslim reform movement and the efforts of people like Zudi Jatta.
It's interesting. I was at an interfaith conference at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York several years ago, and there were a few different Muslim organizations, and I would assume that most of them would fall under the umbrella of being moderate. But there was also someone from the organization Muslims for Progressive Values. And you could feel the tension in the room, but when the representative of Progressive Values was speaking, oftentimes countering the discussions that the other Muslims were bringing up, it seems like this whole idea of what we in the West understand to be right and left, if we put all of our notions as to what's right and what's left in a hat and then just threw it up in the air, that's how we'd have to define right and left when it comes to this subject easily, because here you have, for instance, both very, very conservative Christian evangelicals would agree on a lot of the social understandings that the extremely conservative Muslims would agree to, right? And in terms of how to live your life. And then you have people on the left, Westerners on the left, who sort of champion Muslims more so than they would evangelicals, even though they share the same values. One real easy low-hanging fruit here is LGBT issues. Right, the American left seems to give a pass to what is really moderate Islam. Moderate Islam, it might be moderate politically, but it still can be extremely socially conservative. Correct?
Yes. This is especially the subject of LGBT is particularly interesting because I mentioned last week that. There's an interesting new movement within American Islamism to unify American Islamists by loosening the religious dogma and broadening the political tent under which they organize. And one of the best examples to see that is with regards to LGBT groups. Astonishingly, these modern Salafi clerics have openly declared that this is worth making alliances with LGBT groups. Many of the clerics who are saying this, I have found on video and in audio, advocating violence against LGBT members in the past. You have, so the same clerics who were saying flog and kill them a few years ago are now saying work with them politically to get what we want. And the reasoning for which is they're quite open. They say we both share, both the LGBT movement and the Islamist movement have a common goal, and that is to challenge, and this is certainly imposing an agenda on most LGBT members, I feel, but this is how the Islamists see it. They say we share an agenda, and that is to fight hatred against minorities perpetuated by the status quo. And so Islamists, including the most violent homophobes, can now be found working together with various gay rights groups. Much to the fury, by the way, of the more traditional Islamists, who are apoplectic with rage that Islam should be diluted so much. So yes, this is particularly complicated. But there are also, of course, Islamists who see what, say, the evangelicals believe. They see, as you pointed out, they see this as something to agree on, to bond over. And so there is a movement within what we refer to as purist Salafi Islam. There is a movement within American purist Salafism to reach out to the evangelical community and to build bridges there. So yeah, Islam is diverse. Islamism is diverse. It tries to make friends with all different sorts of groups for all different sorts of reasons to advance or defeat various political goals and agendas. You mentioned Muslims for Progressive Values. I think there's a really good example of a Muslim group that tries to fit in so hard and is rejected at every turn. Muslims for Progressive Values very much wants to be part of what it regards as the mainstream Muslim community. But because the mainstream Muslim community is run by Islamists, they won't let Muslims for Progressive Values get anywhere near. So when Muslim Progressive Values, when their leader says something critical to Ilhan Omar, she is screamed at by Islamists in front of a whole room of Muslims. When Muslim Progressive Values tries to set up a stall at the Islamic Society of North America, a very large Islamist-founded organization that holds one of the biggest conferences in the Muslim calendar. When Muslims for Progressive Values tries to set up a stall there that mentions their support for gay rights, they're chucked out of the convention. So there's this enormous tension, yes, palpable, enormous tension between various elements of the Muslim community. And I have to say that things like interfaith dialogue have mostly, in my experience, have mostly been used, exploited by Islamists, to advance their own interests and silence or at least diminish the influence of moderates and reformists. This doesn't happen all the time, of course. And you know, the fact that you went to a Council for Foreign Relations meeting and there were Muslims for Progressive Values there is good. But many interfaith conferences that I've seen and groups that I've seen tend to see Muslims ignored and Islamists welcomed. And that's very alarming.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU Radio. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today from the Middle East Forum is Sam Westrup, and we're talking about Islamism. Another thing real quick I have to point out in this whole right-left conundrum where right isn't always right and left isn't always left is when you have more progressive women who are sympathetic to people they believe are victims of Islamophobia. They will like wear a hijab in support of their Muslim sisters. And then you have these progressive Muslims saying, no, don't do that. That's not helping our cause. It's just fascinating. It seems that there are so many organizations here in the West that have ties to some form of Islamism. Would you think that there are a lot of American Muslims who support these organizations and they're not completely aware of their missions, or at least some leg of their missions?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, once a month, I will get a message from a member of what we consider to be a prominent Islamist group saying, look, I've read all your stuff. This is completely new to me. I didn't realize this. And either disagreeing with me or then saying, well, actually, that makes sense because I've seen this and this. Undoubtedly, Islamists subsist on the naivety of their Muslim supporters. Islamist charities in this country. Oh, let me give you a few examples. There are two huge Islamist aid charities in the United States. There's actually lots more than that, but these are the two I will focus on. One is Islamic Relief, which was founded by the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in the UK and has a big branch now in the US. It's the largest Muslim charity in the US. It gets millions from the US government and other Western governments. Islamic Relief raises enormous amounts from the American Muslim community, who give to it because Islamic Relief genuinely does do good things. It does house the homeless. It does feed the hungry. It does send goats halfway around the world to be sacrificed and for Muslim religious festivals. It does all the things that Muslims want to support. However, it also helps support radical Islamic movements around the world, including reportedly, arguably, Hamas, the Palestinian terrorist group, and other extremist movements. This is not my opinion. This is something that Islamic Relief has been designated in Israel as a terrorist organization, has been designated in the United Arab Emirates, a pious Muslim country, as a terrorist organization. It's under investigation in various European countries. There's reports of federal investigations here in the U.S. into Islamic Relief activities. And undoubtedly, you can find dozens of examples. In fact, just last week, the Times of London reported that the head of Islamic Relief had been caught referring to Jews as the grandchildren of monkeys and pigs. And the fact that the extremism was so violent, he was forced to step down. Their links to Islamism, their links to hatred and possibly to terrorist movements as well, has been investigated thoroughly, and a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of some direct evidence as well. And yet the vast majority of American Muslims, firstly, have no idea that this is happening, and secondly, they're happy to donate anyway, because they know that despite Islamic Relief problems, it is also doing good work at the same time. And this is the curious thing about the Islamist charitable industry. One other example is a group called Helping Hand for Relief and Development. It is the U.S. proxy for Jamaati Islami, a group I mentioned last week, a South Asian Islamist movement, violent South Asian Islamist movement, responsible for a great deal of violence in Kashmir and Bangladesh and elsewhere. Helping Hand for Relief and Development, or HHRD, a huge American 501c3, raises tens and tens of millions a year. We caught them a few years ago working with Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan, which is the group, the terrorist group responsible for the 2008 Mumbai attacks, which some of your listeners may remember, which took the lives of far too many. HHRD is wildly popular in many circles of American Islam. It gets a lot of support from local officials in various state governments. It and its sister branches have been involved very much in helping fight corona and set up various food assistance, food pantries, and other forms of charitable assistance. Muslims will continue to support it. Non-Muslims will continue to support it because it does some good work. It just so happens that it's also involved with one of the most brutal South Asian terrorist organizations of our age. So this is a very confusing situation for people. And I think that the worst thing we can do is suggest that somehow all Muslims are complicit in these groups' extremism. No, Muslims and non-Muslims are manipulated by these charities. There's a reason these charities mix terror with charity, and that's for the purpose of manipulation. They're using charity to advance an extremist ideal. They're using charity to subsidize terror, to subsidize hate, to subsidize extremism. This has always been and will always be the work of an extremist few who are very good at imposing their will upon others, others who are too well-meaning and too naive to realize they're being manipulated. This is the way extremist movements work, not just with Islamism, but all sorts of extremism. It just so happens the Islamists are very good at it.
I was introduced to Jamaat-e-Islami, I mean, not personally. I didn't have tea with them, but I was introduced to them as an organization in Washington, D.C. one time when I was doing some work down there. And they tell me that they have the most professional advocates and lobbyists working in Washington, D.C., and they've really been able to sell themselves as a very legitimate organization. And also that South Asia is the focal point of a tremendous amount of Islamism at this point, more so than in the past. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not so sure, more so than in the past. It all depends what you mean by more so. I mean, in 1971, when Bangladesh was fighting for its independence, because it was then East Pakistan, it was fighting for its independence from Pakistan, Islamists murdered hundreds of thousands of people in coordination with the Pakistani army. In fact, Jamaat-e Islami led that acts of genocide. And, of course, after the war, and by the way, many of these Jamaat-e Islami leaders fled to the West, including the U.S., where they set up some of the Muslim community groups we now refer to as Islamist-led. So Islamism has always been around in South Asia. In fact, arguably, modern 20th century Islamism was founded in South Asia. Abdul Alim Maududi was around at the same time as Sayyid Qutb, the great Egyptian Islamist. In fact, Abdul Alim Maududi published some of his work before Sayyid Qutb. So in some ways, he's the great first Islamist. So no, Islamism is not new to South Asia, nor is it necessarily growing in influence. I mean, groups like Jamaat-e Islami have less power in Pakistan than they did 10 years ago, thanks to them being essentially kicked out of Bangladesh and to their diminishing political support in Pakistan, the current attempt by the Indian government to suppress Jamaat-e Islami in parts of the country, including General Kashmir, have had some effect as well. But what South Asian Islamism is these days is much better organized. I think a good example of that is the thing you mentioned, which is the fact that there's lobbying representatives and governments and think tanks in D.C., and not just proxy movements here in the U.S. are doing that, but in fact, Jamaat-e Islami in Bangladesh and in Pakistan are sending lobbyists and hiring lobbyists in D.C. to meet with representatives and to advance their cause. We worked on a resolution currently before Congress, House Resolution 160, which calls attention to this, which calls attention to the fact that Jamaat-e Islami is trying to exploit Western mindsets and that it is actually a dangerous force that must be opposed. I think there is a beginning, finally, that a number of people in Congress, a number of people in government are starting to understand that Jamaat-e Islami isn't just an interesting sounding group from far away. It represents a very powerful South Asian Islamist force that is linked to an enormous amount of violence and extremism. Jamaat-e Islami is good at what they do. They are the prime example of what we call lawful Islamists. They're an interesting example of lawful Islamists because in the East, they kill. They maim, they blow up, they murder. In the West, they lobby. And that's how Jamaat-e Islami likes to function. It likes to adapt. It's malleable. It adapts its methods to what it thinks will be most useful in whatever country. In the U.S., that's lobbying, that's exploiting media, that's getting involved with interfaith dialogue and other things. So it's a complicated group with a very complex way of approaching, of attempting to advance its influence. The thing we would very much appreciate would be if the government would enforce existing law and really make sure that foreign agents registration, the fact that people who are lobbying on behalf of a foreign group or foreign power must declare themselves, we're fairly sure a lot of people who lobby on behalf of Jamaat-e Islami and also foreign Islamist states are not declaring themselves as foreign agents. If the American government, the federal government, were to enforce existing law, it seems to me that a lot of this Islamist influence could be countered.
When I look at how the United States has been dealing with Islamism over the past few years, of course, I often base my understanding comparing it to how European countries have done so. And I've seen a number of videos of Islamist demonstrations in England where they're extremely vocal about tearing down the British system and replacing it with a caliphate or some other Islamic state, which just blows me away that it's, because I haven't seen that in the United States. I mean, maybe it's happened, but I haven't seen it, where I've just seen several videos. Is that still the case? Do you still see that very angry protest in opposition to the British government by Islamists?
Yeah, the group you're referring to is called Al-Muhajirin, and its leader Anjem Chowdhury has been a regular face of Islamism on British and American media. In fact, he loves to go on to Fox News and he wants to. This is a good example of Islamists who are trying really hard to be the bad guy. They want to be seen. They want to be seen as shocking. They want to say the wrong thing, as it were. That's not to say they're not dangerous. Dozens of terrorists have been associated with this group that you've seen protesting. That said, they're the obvious Islamists. They're the Islamists who, there's a reason they also go on TV. In some ways, they're a distraction from the Islamist influence that has gripped Muslim communities behind the scenes that is less focused on. So sure, seeing lots of Islamists dressed in black screaming death to democracy and to hell with freedom of speech and down with the British state is shocking, but actually it's not as dangerous as the fact that Islamists in, say, the city of Birmingham, England, took over the local school system, or Islamists in Dewsbury in North England have taken over the town. Or that Islamists in East London took over an entire London borough at one point with billions of pounds at their, dollars at their command and used it to set up radical schools, and from which, of course, a large number of recruits to ISIS came. So the point I'm trying to make here is that let us not be, just as ISIS and Al-Qaeda is not the entire Islamist threat, nor is a bunch of people in niqabs and dressed in black and long Salafi beards screaming obscenities. Islamism is at its most dangerous when it's being more careful, when it's being more pernicious. And that's the thing we should really worry about. This is the Islamism we need to be most concerned about. The Islamism that will be here for the next 30, 40 years, thanks to a slow infiltration of Western institutions. The Islamism that is short and sharp and shocking and found on Fox News or on the streets of London, that's tabloid Islamism. It's interesting to watch. It doesn't mean much in the long run.
I appreciate that, Sam, and we're out of time for this episode, but I want to thank you so much for your time today and last week as well.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My guest has been Sam Westropp, and we've had a fascinating conversation about Islamism in today's world. You can learn more about Sam's work at meforum.org. I'm Fred Stella. This is Common Threads on WGVU. Please join us again next week.